He's not going to become a political advisor like some other.
Anyway, let's read and see what happens here. Text 1, chapter 22. Maitreya Uvacha. You read if you want.
Evam Avishkrita Shesha Guna Karmodayo Munim Savrida Ivatam Samrad Upadatam Uvacha.
Sri Maitreya said, after describing the greatness of the emperors, manifold qualities and activities, the sage became silent, and the emperor, feeling modesty, addressed him as follows.
So the real Kshatriya and the real Brahman, meeting one another, they actually are very respectful. They're very careful in their dealings with one another. Both of them, both Manu, the Kshatriya, Kardama, the Brahman, they both realize that they're dealing with somebody very important, not someone to be trifled with. And they're both feeling actually quite humble. Kardama is feeling honored to be visited by the king, the emperor. And the emperor will hear how he feels about meeting Kardama in the next few verses. Anyway, the emperor says, it says here the emperor feels very modest, embarrassed. Kardama didn't say very much. He just simply commented that, you, the king, protect the citizens. You embody the protecting energy, power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if you didn't travel the earth on your chariot, followed by your mighty army, then human society would become disrupted. And it was a very, very simple presentation, just a few statements. He didn't elaborate very much on the whole science of politics. He just simply, in a few words, delimited what is the proper function of the Kshatriya and what's the glory of the Kshatriya, this great service that he does. Okay, so we can go ahead to verse 2.
Text 2. Manuruvacha Brahma Svijat Samukato Yushman Atma Paritsaya Chandu Mayas Tapo Vidya Yoga Yuktan Alam Partan.
Manu replied, to expand himself in Vedic knowledge, Lord Brahma, the personified Veda, from his face created you, the Brahmanas, who are full of austerity, knowledge, and mystic power, and a reverse to sense gratification.
So Manu,
he's not a fool. He's very well educated in Vedas and in the Dharma Shastras. He understands what's a Brahman. He says the Brahmins were created from the mouth of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is simply the representative of the Supreme Lord, his agent for creating this world. In the Purusha Sukta, it's stated Brahmins are created from the mouth of Lord Vishnu. Lord Garbhadakshaya Vishnu alone was present at the beginning of creation, the Purusha, the Mahapurusha. And when the demigods first appeared from the glance of Mahavishnu, then appeared within the universe and took up their functions, ruling the different elements in the universal form, the universal form which manifests from Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, from his lotus navel. They wanted to do their duty to create the universe, but creation and all other useful activity in this world has to be performed on the basis of sacrifice. So the demigods knew they had to perform a sacrifice. How can they do this? The world hasn't even been put together yet. Nowadays in India, it's hard to perform a proper Vedic sacrifice because, for one reason, you can't get pure ghee. Well, at least on the market. You have your own cow, maybe you can do it. But that's why Indian housewives don't cook in ghee so much. They use oil because if they buy vegetable oil, at least they know what they're getting. But if you try to purchase ghee, you don't know, you never know whether it's cow ghee, buffalo ghee, or whatever. What's in it? So you can't perform sacrifice because that's not available. The top pure ingredients are hard to find. But to speak at the beginning of creation, when there was nothing available, there wasn't any ghee on the market, there wasn't any market, there wasn't any planets. So Vedic sacrifice has so many stipulations. You need 7 different kinds of wood. You need clay utensils. You need so many physical things to perform the sacrifice. So many specific offerings that have to be made. Nothing's available. You know, even the 10 elements haven't been put together yet to make anything. So the demigods were in a quandary. Again, Lord Vishnu personally intervened to help. And he provided his own body in the shape of the universal form to supply the ingredients of sacrifice. So it's described in the Purusha Sutta, specifically, how that in the beginning of creation, the ruling demigods, the creators, performed the first sacrifice from the body, using for the ingredients the body of Bharadvaja Vishnu. And there it describes that from the mouth of the Purusha came the Brahmins. What's the function of the mouth? Speak and, well, there's input and output. The output is speaking, the input is eating. So on behalf of the Supreme Lord, the Brahmins speak and they eat. How do you feed Lord Vishnu? Okay, if you are a Brahmin, you can worship the Shalagram Shila. And it says, the stipulation is for Brahmin, if he eats anything before doing Shalagram worship, then he goes to hell. What about people who aren't fit to install or to worship the Shalagram? What are they supposed to do? So you can worship, you can feed the Supreme Lord by feeding the Brahmins. You know, Lord Vishnu eats through the mouth of the Brahmins. This is very important. The rest of society, who don't have initiation, don't have diksha, don't have upanayana, and can't directly themselves worship the Supreme Lord in the Shalagram or any other form, they can serve the Brahmins. Just by feeding the Brahmins, they're feeding the Supreme Person. That's one of the functions of the mouth of the Supreme, represented by the mouth of the Brahmin. And then the Brahmin speaks the Vedic knowledge out of his mouth. Vedas are meant originally, the original knowledge which manifests the intelligence of God is meant to be spoken and heard. Prabhupada talks in the purport somewhere in this chapter how one's relationship with the guru is not with all the senses, it's with the ear. One deals with the guru using only one's ear, not the other senses. The important interaction with the guru is to hear from him. So the Vedic knowledge has to be transmitted by the Brahmin speaking and the rest of the people hearing. The Vedas are not meant originally to be written down and studied with the eyes. Or put into on a hard drive, transmitted over internet. This is not the original means of transmission. It's by use of the mouth and the ears. Actually, the injunction is there that it's aparad to study the Vedas out of a book. In the ancient times,
before Kali Yuga. So the Brahmin students go to the Gurukul and they learn by rote memorization, not by sticking their nose in the book. It was offensive to even write down the Vedas, or certainly to study the Vedas out of the book. Nowadays, people don't have the strong intelligence to memorize anything anymore. So the ancient system is not practical anymore. So it's okay, we study out of books. But the original system is, no, not out of books, using your ears. Pay attention, not just, you know, flip a page and stare at something. A Brahmin is traditionally called Sutta Kanti. Kanta is mouth, rather throat. And sutra are the aphorisms of knowledge, like the Vedanta Sutra. Or a beginning student, young student studies grammar, he studies Panini's sutras, 4,000 sutras that contain all the rules of Sanskrit grammar. And Sutra Kanti means that he's got these sutras, these sound bites of Vedic knowledge on the tip of his tongue, in his throat, means on the tip of the tongue. He can bring up from his well-trained memory any piece of information needed. If you learn by oral reception properly from a young age, then you get that kind of strong memory, and all the knowledge is on the tip of your tongue. But if you learn out of books, then you have to consult, you know, open up the dictionary and look up everything. That's not real knowledge. Especially if you just cram the books the night before you take a test, and the day after you take the test, you forget it all. Anyone who's studied in an Indian school, this is modern Indian education, just pass the test and forget everything. Someone who's got an MA, PhD in Sanskrit can't speak a word. He's passed all his exams and forgotten everything the next day. Real Brahminical education is hearing. So, therefore, very important function of the Brahmins. The Brahmins are the teachers. And besides eating, the output from their mouths is the valuable instructions of the Vedic revelation that they speak. Anyway, this is going to be discussed a little more in the verses. To expand himself in Vedic knowledge, Lord Brahma, the personified Veda, created from his face created you, the Brahmins. And then he concisely lists the main qualities of proper Brahmins, who are full of austerity, knowledge, and mystic power, and are averse to sense gratification. If someone could develop these four qualities, four, then he can be called a Brahmin. He's a proper Brahmin. Not that this is easy. These to actually live according to these standards cannot be done superficially. It comes, it used to come by good birth. You know, the first thing that helps you get a good start to becoming austere, learned, full of Brahma Tejas, and to be disinterested in sense gratification. In ancient times, the first great advantage that helps you rise to that standard is to take a good birth in a Brahmin family. So again, going back to the Vedic times, in the Upanishads we read so many lists of family descent. You know, so-and-so rishi was the son of this rishi, and his grandfather was this rishi, and his great-grandfather was that rishi, going back 20, 30 generations. When you're born in such a family, when everybody was a great Brahmin, learned, austere, full of mystic power and disinterested in sense gratification, then naturally, having that kind of blood in your veins, that's the first good advantage. And then if you get a proper education and you get proper spiritual and material guidance, then you can become like that. You know, with a 20, 30 years of training, then you can become a proper Brahmin.
Any comments or questions here? Okay. Did anybody hear that? Yeah. Is it okay for a Brahmin to speak something he hasn't fully realized? It's not so good. Yeah. Sometimes we have to speak things that we've heard and we simply repeat. Yeah. Many of the things we say, if you're asked to give a Bhagavatam class, we say so many things we have no real personal realization of. Talk about love of God and so many things that we only know by name. So very often we can't avoid talking about things that we don't have much realization about. And we simply repeat, try not to change even the words, because we don't really know what we're talking about. But effective preaching, or effective teaching for a Brahmin, of anything, should be based on personal realization. Yeah. If you want to be a good preacher, then talk about what you know. Don't talk above your own head. Try to stick to what you've realized. But sometimes we have to. Sometimes we don't have much realization, we have to just say things repeating what the previous authorities have said. Yes, please. Yes. I'm speculating now, but I don't think it means cheap tricks, you know, to dazzle the audience and, you know, impress people. No, I think the mystic power is to be able to change people's hearts. Prabhupada said that about himself. My mystic power, two things that he said. One was that he can change Europeans and Americans into Vaishnava Brahmins. That's a mystic feat. It's like trying to wash coal, he said. Another thing he said, I can be in a room with 100 beautiful women and not be disturbed. That's my mystic power. So I think it's the mystic power to just by your words, change people's hearts and change reality. By giving your blessings to someone or cursing someone, you're creating a reality. That's like a magic trick. I bless you, you know, that you will attain love of God, that your life will become perfect. Just by those words, he's creating the reality. That's magic. Or similarly, a curse. You know, you're going to be a serpent in your next life. So that's mystic power. The power of the Brahman to create reality just by saying something. That's the Brahminical mystic power. Does that make sense? Yeah. I mean, that's what we see all the time. Brahmins just saying something, and then someone's life is totally changed by them having said a few words.
Yes, okay. Tapo Vidya Yoga. Yeah. Prabhupada is translating the word yoga as mystic power.
It could be translated otherwise. I would guess, you know, I know. From my familiarity with how Prabhupada writes his purports, he usually doesn't just make a...
Okay, anything else here?
Okay. Lord Brahma created the Brahmanas from his mouth, and the statement here is Atma Paripsaya. The purpose, the intention that Lord Brahma had was to... Atma Paripsaya. Now, this word, Paripsaya,
translation says one thing, the word for word, the purport says another. To protect himself by expanding. This is interesting.
The Lord Brahma, to protect himself, he expanded the Brahmins. Or to protect the Vedic knowledge. The Brahmins are the guardians of Vedic knowledge. And in that way, they're protecting the whole universe by maintaining the Vedic knowledge. If the principles of Dharma are maintained, then the universe is safe. If the principles of Dharma are in disorder, then the universe is in danger of chaos. And by maintaining the Vedic knowledge and the system of Vedic sacrifice, that maintains the principles of Dharma. So it's an essential function of the Brahmins to help maintain the peace and the order security of the universe, of creation, to teach and live the principles of Dharma, according to the Vedas. This is as important and more important than the physical protection that the Kshatriyas give and the demigods. Demigods are managing the universe. But the sages, the original Brahmins, they're doing a more important function of maintaining the principles of religion, without with which, no matter how good the managers, the demigods are, everything will fall into chaos if the principles of Vedic Dharma are not maintained properly. So the Brahmins' function is even more important than the Kshatriyas. Or in other words, the sages are more important than the demigods.
So Atma Paripsaya, first Prabhupada says in the word for word, to protect himself by expanding. And then Prabhupada says in the translation, he translates the same phrase, Atma Paripsaya, as to expand himself in Vedic knowledge. Prabhupada usually doesn't contradict himself. He doesn't say opposite things in the word for word and in the translation. So they must be equivalent. Lord Brahma protecting himself by expanding means the same thing as his expanding the Vedic knowledge. That's how he protects himself. That's how he protects the universe, by expanding the Vedic knowledge through the Brahmins. The Brahmins are the ones who do that, are his agents in doing that. Okay, so these four qualities of the Brahmins that Manu is seeing in Kardama. These two gentlemen are not just flattering one another because they have a business deal to transact. Manu has a daughter to get rid of. Kardama needs to find a wife, and therefore they're polite to one another. No. They are actually very appreciative of one another because they recognize the real qualities of Brahman and Kshatriya in one another. Manu has been well educated in Vedic science. He knows what a Brahman is, and he sees, oh yes, you've got these qualities. I can see. I've only met you for a few minutes, but I can see. You've spoken a few words to me, not much, but that's enough. I can see that you're full of austerity, knowledge, mystic power, and you are averse to sense gratification. It's obvious. You couldn't speak like this if you didn't have those qualities. Of course, these qualities are necessary qualifications of a learned Brahman. Without austerity, which means, the word is tapas, right? Tapas is the Sanskrit word here. Very interesting word. Original meaning is the heat of fire. Tap means to burn in Sanskrit, or to burn in the sense, not the sense of feel pain, but the fire itself is burning. The fire is burning. It's creating. It's radiating energy. It's what is looking at from the dry scientific point of view. What is fire? It's a very fast, intense chemical reaction of oxidation. A very intense chemical reaction, burning. If same thing could happen, if it happened much slower, it wouldn't be considered burning. But when you have fast conversion of wood to carbon, and then there's oxygen released, whatever happens when there's fire, when it happens fast and intensely, then you see a fire. So the idea of tapas is intense concentration and effort. That is the spiritual meaning of tapas. Literal meaning is the heat and burning intensity of fire. Tap, to burn. The spiritual idea behind that is the concept of intense concentration and intense effort. It's interesting, it's stated, I think it's the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it describes how the Supreme Personality of Godhead created this world by tapas. So tapyata. He, the Supreme Lord, he was the first one to perform austerity. But why does God have to perform austerity? He doesn't have to deprive himself of anything.
take any vows or fast or stand on his head. So it's not tapas in that sense of deprivation or voluntary pain. The Supreme Lord never feels any pain. But he created this world by intense concentration of effort. Now, creation is always an intense effort. When a mother gives birth to a child, it's a very intense effort. For the child to come out of the mother's body is a great effort for the child and the mother. So when the Lord, he's the original mother and father, when he creates the universe, he's exerting himself with great intensity for our benefit. That's tapas. When the sages prepare themselves for doing their functions, whether it's populating the universe or disseminating Vedic knowledge, they perform austerities for many thousands of years. That's also tapas. The purpose of it is to gather their energies, to focus themselves with great intensity. So that's the power of Brahmins. Kshatriyas, they build up their muscles and their physical strength and their political strength, and then they squander it all in battles. They have a one-day battle and they use up all their energy. But Brahmins, they focus their energy. They don't squander it. They use it very sparingly. Brahma-tejas. Yes? So Kshatriyas also are advised to perform austerity. They build up their batteries also, but they discharge their batteries in a different way than the Brahmins do. It's tapas for the purpose of conquest, which is their duty. It's the duty of the Kshatriyas to conquer the world and then rule it. So they prefer, also tapas is required for that. Yes. Brahmatejas, yeah. That's the tejas and tapas are very similar words. Tejas is power or radiant light, radiant heat is the literal meaning of tejas. The element fire is sometimes called tejas. So tejas can be just translated as fire. It's the power of the Brahmins, the intelligent power. Now the power by which, just by saying a few words, they can change reality. They can condemn someone to hell or to curse him or bless him with love of God, just by saying one or two words. That's Brahmatejas. That power that's even much stronger than the political or economic power that others have. Yes. So it says, to create. Yes, or Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, both of them, Mahavishnu and Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, at the beginning of creation. This is a description of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and Chandogya Upanishad also. He concentrated. He concentrated his attention very carefully. Of course, there's not no pain involved for the Supreme Lord. It's just a pastime. Another sport for him. Sometimes Krishna likes to be a rishi. He likes to perform that pastime also. So sometimes he wants to also be a rishi and do austerities. It's his pleasure. Or he takes birth as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He wants to experience what it's like to be an austere Brahmin.
Austerity, knowledge.
Of course, everybody can have some knowledge. The Vaishyas know how to do arithmetic, how to take care of cows, farm, and do business. The Kshatriyas know a lot of things. Even the Shudras know they have their practical skills if they have an occupation. But the knowledge of the Brahmins is knowledge of Dharma, knowledge of the Vedas. That is their special privilege. Kshatriyas also study the Vedas, but they don't become teachers of the Vedas, normally. That's the prerogative of the Brahmins. So, the knowledge belongs to the Brahmins. They share it with everybody, but it's their property, the Vedic knowledge. And you can see who has assimilated this teaching of the Vedas by a person's behavior, sadachara. Someone with the eyes of Manu, who's also very cultured, can see right away by being with somebody for a few minutes and hearing a few words out of his mouth, you can recognize right away this person has such proper behavior, and he has such a proper attitude toward others. He must be full of Vedic knowledge. No other way that someone could act like this. Can't be imitated, or at least an imitation could be quickly spotted by someone as well educated as Manu. And the mystic power we already mentioned. And then the last quality is a Brahmin has to be averse to sense gratification. He can have all these other good qualities. He could have the power to perform yogic discipline for many years. He can be full of, know all the mantras and the Vedas backwards and forwards, and all the explanations of them. And he could have mystic powers coming out of his ears. But if he's attracted to sense gratification, that spoils everything. It can be arranged to drag him down very easily. Indra, who's very envious of someone who might take his position, very often sends the apsaras or somebody else to make these would-be sages fall down. So if there's interest in sense gratification, then it's not very easy to maintain a steady position on the Brahminical platform. A Brahmin has to live a very simple life, not too much sense enjoyment, not too much opulence. It's very dangerous for a Brahmin to accept more than he needs. It's said that he shouldn't even collect more than he can use in a single day. That's first-class Brahmin. A Brahmin, a Brahmin, minimum is he can't collect more than he can use in 3 years. I think the mother says that. Sometimes Brahmins, have families and they feel the need to, protect their families. So, okay, maximum is you can store grains for 3 years. Any more than that, you're a sense gratifier. Okay, it can be imagined, maybe you have a big family, and maybe in your country, the climate is unsteady and there can be famines. Okay, you can store grains for 3 years, no more than that. Better than that if you can keep it down to 1 year or 1 month. But a first-class Brahmin doesn't store more than doesn't store anything. He just keeps what he can use the same day. And if because everybody's giving him charity, if he has more than he can use in a day, he has to give it away immediately. If he wants to be considered a first-class Brahmin. Yeah, you don't keep overnight what you can't eat that day. So, in these few, it is one verse. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Best Brahmin, yes. He's inspiring. Brahmin inspires others to come to a similar standard. Yeah. If he's got Brahma Tejas, if he's got some potency, then other people will also be elevated by his association to also assume these qualities of austerity, knowledge, mystic power, and aversion to sense gratification. So, if a really good Brahmin, if he's got a good family, they'll also be willing to live an austere life, a simple life. You got the example of, very good example of Srivastava Thakur.
Lord Chaitanya glorified him. And he said, everybody in your family also has love of God, even your servants. Usually in India, the servants are Shudras, and you know, usually can't trust them in a room by themselves. They'll steal everything. The Prabhupada said, if a servant doesn't steal from me, he's not very smart. Yeah. But Shivas Thakur's family, even the servants, the menial servants in the household, they were all pure Vaishnavas, you know, Mahabhagavats. And once Nimai Pandit was joking with Srinivas, what are you going to do? You know, I don't see you working. How are you going to maintain your family? You never do any work. You got a big household. So how are you keeping your family secure? You're not collecting any money, you're not doing anything. And Srinivas Thakur clapped his hands 3 times. And Krishna said, what is that? He said, this is my formula. This is how I take care of my family. If we don't get any food for 3 days, then I'll jump in the Ganga and drown myself. You know, in other words, he's completely depending on Krishna's mercy. He just refuses to come down to the material platform. He's confident that Krishna is going to take care of his family, even though he's got a huge household. He doesn't, you know, can't really, nobody, even Lord Chaitanya is wondering how you're going to feed them all. But that's the ideal Brahman. That shouldn't be imitated, you know, by those who don't have that spiritual qualification. Yes, yes. Well, yeah. I mean, therefore, other devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they went out and got jobs because they didn't want to burden Krishna. You know, it's normally a proper attitude for a Vaishnava Grihastha that he should take the trouble to make a proper arrangement to maintain his family rather than dump it on Krishna's head. Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he never got married. He never had any thought of that. But when he finished his university education, he got a bachelor's degree from the University of Calcutta. And what did he do? Okay, he's a Naishika Brahmachari, never intends to get married. He went out and got a job. Because he didn't want to be like these useless sadhus who just sit around and do nothing. Yeah, he's still a brahmachari. He hasn't taken sannyas. So he went and got employment with the Maharaj of Tripura. He became a librarian. Worked for him for a few years. Just to set an example, you know, that you have to take care of yourself, not just expect Krishna to do everything, and not sit around and be idle. But anyway, the principle here is to be averse to sense gratification. Work hard, but working hard not to collect something for our own security and enjoyment, but we work to fulfill our responsibilities in Krishna's service. Everybody works hard, whether they're collecting money or just preaching or doing worship. Every serious Vaishnava is doing this tapas, this intense concentration of working hard for Krishna. So we can see these two gentlemen, why they're appreciating each other. They're both working very hard for the same general common purpose, to further the welfare of human society. The king, his way, and the Brahmin, his way, but it works together very closely. Interknit, they both need each other. We can move on to verse 3 then. I wanted to go a little slow today, where this section here is practically the center point of the whole. You know, here's the actual encounter between the two great personalities, and they don't say much. So we're focusing on every word practically. You see, you know, every little word has deep significance here. One quote here: Manu is describing the glorious qualities of the Brahmins and how this is very essential, or he will be saying, how the Brahmins having these qualities is essential for the maintenance of human society.
In the Taittiriya Brahmana,
which is Taittiriya Samhita, is the black Yajurveda. The Yajurveda that has the mantras and the explanations of the mantras mixed up together, not in separate books. And there is a separate book called the Taittiriya Brahmana anyway, with additional explanations. It's the further commentary on the meaning of the mantras of the Taittiriya Samhita. And in that Taittiriya Brahmana, there's a short statement, Brahmano vai prajanam upadrashta. The Brahmana is the supervisor of all the people. Yeah. Like a father. He has to look after the welfare of everybody, including the king and all the citizens. It's a big responsibility. But he's competent to do it. Just like a father, nature just gives a father the intelligence how to be a father. You usually don't go to school how to be a father. You don't take courses on it. The intelligence is given to you. So similarly, a Brahmin just knows, by his brahminical qualities, he knows how to take care of everybody. Anyway, can we look at verse 3?
Tatranaya srijat chasman duh sahasrat sahasrapat vidayam tasya hi brahma kshatram andram prachakshate.
Okay, so the previous verse talked about Brahma creating the Brahmins from his mouth. But now he's going back to explain it, how this creation actually originally came from the thousand-headed Supreme Personality of Godhead, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. So translation, for the protection of the Brahmanas, the thousand-headed, thousand-legged Supreme Being created us, the Kshatriyas, from his thousand arms. Hence the Brahmins are said to be his heart, and the Kshatriyas his arms. Brahmins are sometimes described as coming from the mouth of the Supreme, and sometimes they're described as his heart, or the head of society. In any case, the Brahmins are the essential part. They're the life center, and especially the source of intelligence, of direction. And the Kshatriyas are the arms. The arms manifest the physical strength, the protecting strength. So, the Kshatriyas are very powerful. God gives them, they embody the protecting strength of the Lord. An effective Kshatriya is invincible. At least within his own domain, no one could even approach him. Durdarsha, unapproachable. But to speak of defeating him, most people can't even come near him. He's so powerful. But, because he's functioning in the mode of passion, his intelligence can become clouded. Especially since he's got his domain, but if he's not God, his domain is limited. And there's some other ruler in the next domain. Surrounding him, there are potential enemies. So the Kshatriyas get into conflicts with one another. The mode of passion turns into warfare and descends into the mode of ignorance. So the intelligence of the Kshatriyas, if left untempered, undirected, by higher intelligence, can get in trouble, can become misguided. Therefore, the Brahmins have to guide the intelligence of the Kshatriyas. The Brahmins need the Kshatriyas because they're totally vulnerable. They've forfeited, or they've passed up the opportunity to protect themselves. They're depending completely on Krishna's mercy. That's fine if you're living out in the jungle, just you and Krishna. But if you're in the city or in the human society, there are so many people who can abuse you or just neglect you. You know, out in your ashram in the Himalayas or in the jungle, there, Mother Nature is providing everything. You just pick the fruits off the trees and the roots in the ground. But in a big city, how are you going to live unless people are willing to give you charity? So the Brahmins, when they enter human society, they need the physical protection of the Kshatriyas. They can't survive, or they can't function in any useful way without the protection of the Kshatriyas. They can manage on their own, but if they're going to be of any use in the ordinary social order, they have to be supported by the Kshatriyas. They can survive on their own, but they can't function practically without the help of the Kshatriyas. But the Brahmins come first. You can live without arms. Not convenient. If someone chops off your arms, your life is going to be somewhat limited. You'll have to find some other way to operate your computer. You won't have any hands. But you can survive. But if someone chops your head off, you're dead. Or carves out your heart, you're dead. Therefore, the Brahmins come first. They're the most essential. And Prabhupada quotes the prayer, Namo Brahmanya Devaya Go Brahman Hitaya Cha Jagat Hitaya Krishnaya Govindaya Namo Namaha. Obeisances to Govinda. So just looking at what the word means, Govinda, possessor of Go, that means that he's Brahmanya Devaya. Meaning of Govinda is that he's the protector of the Brahmins and the cows. First of all, the Brahmins and the cows. Of course, Krishna protects everybody. Jagat Hitaya. He's the protector of the whole world. He's working for the benefit, Hita, of the whole world. But first, the Brahmins and the cows. That doesn't mean, Brahmins and cows, I'm taking care of, everyone else can go to hell. No. By protecting, first of all, the Brahmins and the cows, that's how the best way to protect everybody else. If the Brahmins are maintained, they're peaceful, they can sit down and do their brahminical functions, then human society gets proper guidance. Then the Kshatriyas can be strong and effective, and everybody else will be peaceful. If the cows are maintained, then religious principles will be fortified. Then Krishna is pleased. Then the mode of goodness is promoted, if the cows are protected. And there'll be abundant milk products, healthy food. So these two classes, the cows and the Brahmins and the cows, have to be protected first in order to protect everybody. The priority, we shouldn't be ashamed, we shouldn't be afraid to promote this Varnashram concept. We shouldn't think that, this is the modern world, nobody's going to buy it. It's just politically incorrect to talk about or to even come out and say that ISKCON is in favor of Varnashram. But that's our business. Because this is how to benefit everyone. It's not that we're going to, have a privileged class, the Brahmins and the cows, and everybody else gets exploited and oppressed. Just the opposite. By giving priority to the Brahmins and the cows, then everybody is benefited. That's the meaning of this mantra. And Manu realizes that. He's not at all shy to bow down to Kardama Muni, this young man who he never met before, who is sitting in his ashram covered with ashes, dressed in rags, doesn't have a penny in his pocket. He's ready to bow down, put his head at his feet, and give him his daughter. Any comments or questions? Okay, we can look at verse 4. Yes, ma'am. That can only be realized if you're living a natural lifestyle. You know, if you're living artificially, then it's hard to see. You can, you know, just understand it theoretically. But if you're living on the land and you have a cow, you can see it. How it's a natural ecology. Yes. That we know enough of demoniac culture. You just keep the cows to make turn into hamburgers.
Okay, this leads right into text 4.
Ato yanyonyamatmanam brahma kshatram cha rakshataha rakshati smadhyayo devaha sayat sarasaratmakaha.
That is why the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas protect each other, as well as themselves. And the Lord Himself, who is both the cause and effect and is yet immutable, protects them through each other.
Rakshataha.
So the word rakshataha, or protects, the two of them protect one another. This is the key idea here.
And then he says again, rakshati, in the third line.
You think of Kshatriyas as protectors. Brahmins, we were discussing, Brahmins are protecting by maintaining religious principles. They're actually a stronger force. They're a much more subtle and potent force than the physical strength of the Kshatriyas.
Prabhupada discusses in the purport
how this whole system that begins with the cooperation, mutual working together of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, it's a system for cooperation so that everybody can be uplifted to the highest platform of spiritual realization. We were attracted to ISKCON for this reason, more or less, I think. We may have had, in the beginning, other attractions. I was attracted by samosas. But what really attracts us to give our life to this movement is that it's obviously a movement for universal spiritual upliftment. For ourselves, and then we go out and try to deliver the world. That's our purpose. That's our transcendental spiritual society. But the whole Varnashram system is for that purpose, just in a broader way. You know, it expands itself and deals more with the material energy, deals more with the material conditioned situation of the living entities, and has to work out ways. The Varnashram system contains means for human beings of all different kinds to be able to work together, live cooperatively and peacefully, progressively. But the ultimate purpose is the same as a society, a purely spiritual society of renunciants. And it is that everybody become fully Krishna conscious. Especially the Daivi Varnashram system. Modern world is degenerated because the sages are gone. And there's nobody with pure spiritual intentions guiding the Varnashram system. So it becomes Rakshasa Varnashram, or the modern caste system. It's just the different classes especially the Brahmins, insisting on their privileges, even though they haven't done anything to deserve it. They want Brahma Bhojana, they want bhakshis, but they can't perform any brahminical service. They've done nothing to deserve the 10 rupees they're demanding. The rulers, the government is trying to maintain their privileges, and every person, every class in society, the women, the different, the tribals, and everybody's trying to push their own separate interests in conflict with everybody else. So there's class struggle and just and conflict instead of cooperation. That's the modern social system, or a modern lack of a system. But what makes Varnashrama, or especially the Daivi Varnashrama, different is the basic foundation of cooperation, of working together peacefully, willingly accepting different roles, voluntarily. Daivi Varnashram is different in that it's guided by pure devotees. When whoever organizes the system, the Brahmins, who are the masterminds, when they have love of God, then they can, because they have it, they can give it to others. And it filters down through the system. Anybody who participates in the system is also going to be gradually elevated to that. Because the leaders, the spiritual leaders, have the highest thing. Others can also get it. If the so-called spiritual leaders don't have spiritual goods, then how can they give it to anybody else? So Daivi Varnashram is organized and led by pure devotees. That's what makes it different. It gives its spiritual potency. It's like Prabhupada said, I will go to Giranagri and I'll show you how to live on the land. The direction is coming from the pure devotee, therefore the potency is there to actually elevate the participants up to the level of pure Krishna consciousness. Even though it's not the same, it's not sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti is not raganuga bhakti. They're two different things. Someone who's practicing the rules and regulations can't claim that he has love of God. Or if he does, he's wrong. He's bewildered or he's a hypocrite. If a person who's simply going through the motions of practicing his vows claims that he has love of God when he doesn't, that's not correct. Because sadhana bhakti is not raganuga bhakti. Raganuga bhakti means to be fully absorbed in love of God and think of Krishna constantly. His pastimes, his personal qualities. Are we doing that? Are we meditating only on Krishna 24 hours a day and no attention at all to the material energy? That's okay, we're not. We have to be honest. We're not on that level. We're on this level, we're practicing sadhana bhakti, trying to. Similarly, the practice of the Varnashram rules and regulations is on a different level, on a lower level still. It's the third rank. But it's part of the same overall system. It's still for the same end. On a lower level, on a broader level, the accepting roles within the Varnashram system and following those rules and regulations that belong to each different role means, from a material level, admitting, okay, I'm conditioned, I can't even come to the level of sadhaka. Still, gradual elevation is provided, facility for gradual elevation. Just like in previous ages, nowadays, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was told everybody in the universe, every man, woman, and child should chant Hare Krishna. In previous ages, that, in effect, initiation of everybody, everybody in the universe is already initiated, has the privilege to chant Hare Krishna. Lord Chaitanya has initiated everybody. So the Harinam Diksha is really just a formality. Anybody can chant the mantra without initiation. You go out, to Times Square and tell everybody to chant along with us. We don't say, hey, you're drunk, you can't chant this mantra. You have to get Diksha first. We don't tell people that. But other mantras you do. Sampradaya vihina ye mantraste nishpalamata. If you don't receive the mantra through a pampara, by initiation, it's useless. We don't say that about Krishna's names, about the Maha Mantra.
Because Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has already given diksha. He's ordered every man, woman, and child in the universe to chant. But in previous ages, that wasn't there. That universal initiation wasn't there. And therefore, this Hare Krishna Mahamantra was not available to everybody. In fact, it was hardly available to anybody. There's 10 offenses. If you commit these offenses, the effects can be worse than not chanting at all. If you chant with offenses, you can undo all the good effects of your chanting and go to hell also. So therefore, normally, this Krishna's name, this Hare Krishna Mahamantra, is only meant to be chanted by those who are free from offenses. Only by very advanced yogis should this mantra be chanted. It's so secret, it's hardly mentioned at all anywhere in the Vedas.